disordered system.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, thank you very much for this introduction and for giving me the opportunity to give this talk here. In particular, it's this very nice place and with this very mixed audience of very applied physicists and even reaching to mathematicians. I must say I'm more on the mathematical side, so that's why I will try to be, and I should say being on the mathematical side, it also means that I usually try to understand things in sort of generality, and I thought that might not be appropriate for this audience, so I will try to be very specific, and obviously I will start with some introduction and motivation first, and that takes already some bulk time, at least of the first hour, and then later we will go into the more technical and more physically relevant things. But the first bit will be an introduction to those, intended for those people who don't really know about the subject. So let me start with introduction and motivation. Okay, so I thought that probably not everybody here in the audience knows what a sigma model is, so let me start with a brief definition of that. So a sigma model can either be classical or quantum, and it's a classical or quantum field theory but of what? A classical or quantum field theory of maps, and I will denote these maps as X mu from one geometric space sigma to another geometric space M. And when I say geometric space, I mean that it's a manifold and it's equipped with a metric. And these X mu's can be sort of being the embedding coordinates of this sigma into M. Okay, so let's write that down. X mu, and that depends on the world, on the coordinates on sigma. So these sigma are coordinates in sigma, say. And these are coordinates for the embedding of sigma into M. So, roughly speaking. And to give two examples, if we assume a one-dimensional sigma model, that means the sigma is one-dimensional, then you can think of this as a line, and if you think about the time direction, I mean, if you think about it as a line parameterizing the time, this embedding basically corresponds to the trajectory of a particle in some other space. So here you have some other space M, for instance a sphere, and then the embedding would be the trajectory here on the space M. Okay, in my talk I won't deal with one-dimensional things, but I will talk about two-dimensional sigma models. And the physically most interesting example is if you take, for instance, a cylinder. Oops. So here you have a cylinder, and again you assume that it's sort of infinitely extended, and that the time direction runs upwards, and that you have a space dimension which goes around the cylinder. And then again you have an embedding, now depending on two coordinates, namely on the time and on the place where you're sitting on the circle. And in this case, the embedding describes the propagation of a string. So you would have, at one instant of time, you would have some sort of circle, and then the circle vibrates and moves around in the target space. So that's maybe a picture for that. And I should say that here, in the following of my talk, I will always assume to deal with a two-dimensional worldsheet, I mean, the sigma is called a worldsheet. I will moreover assume that it's Euclidean, so I won't talk about the time direction, but I assume that there are two space coordinates. And I will also restrict myself to the case that sigma is a complex plane. So I won't talk about cylinders or such things, but I will assume that it's the complex plane. And I will work with complex coordinates as well. So here in this talk, sigma will always be the complex plane. And this, what I denoted here is T and sigma will always mean Z and Z bar, so complex coordinates. Okay, but that's just a sort of kinematical picture. Up to now, I didn't define anything. I just said that there is an embedding of this sigma into the target space, as the M is called a target space. But I also have to specify the dynamics.
Can I just ask quickly? I mean, so far, what you've defined seems so completely general that I don't see what you've excluded with your definition. Could you give an example of what you've excluded?
I have to say, now I will talk about the dynamics, and I will define an action which governs the dynamics, and in this action you will have a kinetic term, and I guess that's basically the presence of that kinetic term is what makes the sigma model. But maybe let me continue, and then you will see the idea. Oops. Okay, so we have to talk about the dynamics, because up to now it's just an sort of arbitrary construction, because it doesn't tell you how the propagation of the string or the particle should look like. And as usual, the dynamics is specified by an action. So you define an action functional depending on these coordinates, which takes values in the real numbers. And this action functional is specified by certain parameters. And all these parameters which enter the action are characteristics of M, of this manifold M. So, first of all, obviously you have the metric, and the metric will be used to define a kinetic term for the field. Then, in addition, you might have fluxes that will be important later. Or you can think of these fluxes as being gauge fields. For instance, you could think about the flat space which has a magnetic field or some electric field. And then obviously a point particle which has some charge can couple to these fields and will modify the action. And then moreover, there might be other fields which are not so relevant here, but let me nevertheless mention them, and here one, for instance, has a dilaton or other things. Okay, so these are the parameters which enter the action, and then obviously the action should reflect the symmetries of my spaces. Okay, and as I already said, there's a crucial feature that it always includes a kinetic term, the action, and typically the action looks as follows. So you have this action, it depends on the coordinates, and it's defined, or at least proportional, to some integral over sigma. So that's this one, that's a two-dimensional integral in my context. And then you have a coupling to the metric. So this G should be the metric of M. Metric of M. And then usually you also have some the metric is the metric is obviously symmetric in the two indices, and then there might also be an anti-symmetric field, which I denote by B mu nu, and that's one of these gauge fields or fluxes that you can have. You don't have to have it, but you can have it. And as we will see later, it's important for some models. And then these fields couple to the derivative of the coordinates. Okay, so that looks all pretty innocent, but what is crucial now is that the metric and the gauge field can again depend on the coordinates where you're sitting. So here you have an usually a very explicit coordinate dependence, and that makes the model highly nonlinear and very hard to solve, at least usually, except for certain cases, and I will later focus on these solvable cases.
Even though it's anti-symmetric, doesn't it work automatically?
Say it again?
For being new anti-symmetric, doesn't that vanish just because of dd bar divided by d squared?
No.
Symmetric.
Why is it symmetric? I mean, it's d and...
Oh, you said you could d.
Just depend on x.
You dd bar is... Oh, it depends on
that. Yeah. Okay, so any questions up to here?
So G is basically completely determined by M.
Yes, and B as well. I mean, okay, you have some freedom to put different Bs on M, but in principle it's also determined by the structure of M. And
okay, so there's some correlation between possible structure for B and M.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's not unique.
No, B can, you can have several fluxes usually. I will talk, and you can also have several metrics for a space, but yeah. So in principle, and these structures are constrained by M, but you still have choices for both of them.
The G is what you call a kinetic term?
Yeah, yeah. The first bit with G is what I call a kinetic term. I mean, if you don't talk about Euclidean two-dimensional spaces, but you have a time direction, then this would really be the standard kinetic term, for instance, in flat space or so.
So I guess it's not relevant for the case of the plane, but for the cylinder, would you have any constraints on the topology of this embedding? Can you have branchings of your string?
In principle, I wouldn't. I mean, if once you fix the sigma, you specified the. I mean, certainly if you start with a cylinder here, you cannot have branching in the target space. So you have to implement that on the level of the sigma already. You have to start with something which looks like a pent here. So then you could have a branching in the target space. So in this sense, it's more specified by sigma. Okay, so let me give some examples. Some special examples, which are probably known in the audience, but let me nevertheless stress these. So first of all, you have what is known as the principal chiral model. Principal chiral model, and that's specified by the constraints that you have M is equal to G, a group manifold. Oops, and moreover, you demand that B is equal to zero. So B mu nu is equal to zero. And then you assume that the metric is compatible with the group structure. So you assume that it's invariant. And these models are nice in some sense. So these models turn out to be integrable. And that is something which has been shown by Lüscher, I guess, in the late 70s. But they are not conformally invariant.
Okay. In general, they are not
in general
invariant.
Yeah, I mean, I will later, as long as I say it's a group, I don't know any example where they are. So probably as long as I say group, they're just never conformally invariant. I will later talk about supergroups, and then we will see that things change. Okay, so the second example would be West-Sumino-Witten models. It's both. I mean, first of all, classically these principal chiral models are even conformally invariant. But once you switch on, once you consider quantum effects, the conformal invariance is destroyed. So that's destroyed. They're also classically integrable, so you can find a Lex connection and define monodromy charges or commuting quantities. And as far as I understood, these models are quantum integrable. So you can define S matrices, satisfying Young-Baxter equations, such things. Okay, so the second examples are so-called West-Sumino-Witten models.
Classical, I mean, you would think of taking the path integral over all field configurations. This is classical or quantum?
That's quantum.
Classical is what?
We just take the equation of motion that follows from the action.
That's a classical.
Yeah.
It's still nonlinear. You see, it's a nonlinear partial differential equation, so you
solve it. Yep. Okay, so the second topic I will mainly be focusing on, although what I will say will certainly also have implications on the first bit once it's conformally invariant. So the West-Sumino-Witten models work in the same setup. So again, you have M is equal to G, a group manifold. But now, B, so these tensors, B mu and G mean U, are adjusted in a certain way. Oops. And this adjustment leads to the fact that these models are conformally invariant. And moreover, they even have a very, very, very large current algebra symmetry. Okay, I will come back to that later.
Large what?
A current algebra symmetry, so a fine Kac-Moody symmetry, if you like. And then there are also coset models. Okay, let me just mention these. So coset models, and they come in two families. Namely, you can consider the subgroup, and coset model, I mean spaces which geometrically look like G over H, where H is a subgroup of G. And this H can act in different ways. If it's just acting from the right, then these models are more like principal chiral models, although they have a B field, and usually they are not conformally invariant. And then you have also the adjoint action, where you act with H from both sides simultaneously. And then these models are called gauged West-Sumino-Witten models and conformally invariant. Okay, so that's roughly the picture. And now I would like to make the next step.
So West-Sumino-Witten model has a West-Sumino term, right?
Yes, this West-Sumino term is the B field.
B field term is like an integral over two-dimensional space.
Yes, I didn't want to complicate things here.
But okay, it's the same thing.
The real physically relevant field, say, I mean, the field strength would be a three form. So you would have an H, which is the total derivative of B. And that's well defined on the whole group. This B is not necessarily well defined on the whole group. So you have different patches, and then you have quantization conditions. But I didn't want to go into these details. Okay. Any further questions up to here? No? Okay. So then we can get closer to the topic of my talk. So here I will consider supergroups. So basically, I would like to discuss these two kinds of models, principal chiral models and West-Sumino-Witten models, not based on groups, but on supergroups. And the best picture of supergroups is probably obtained if you consider matrix supergroups. And a matrix supergroup, for instance, GLM/N, that's the straightforward generalization of GLM. So the invertible matrices in some dimension. So here you have now a separation into blocks, and you say that here in the first block you have matrices A which are even or bosonic. Then here in the second block you have fermions chi which are odd or fermionic. Then you have fermions here and again bosons here. So you have some graded structure in your matrix. And this is, so the length of these is M and the length of this is N, and the same here. So you have M and this is N.
So just a comment, the notion of fermionic bosonic is saying that it's here the Nekrasov dog,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can think of these as Grassmann variables, and these would be odd parts, so even number of Grassmann variables, this would be, no, even, and this would be odd, so odd number of Grassmann variables. And obviously you have to demand invertibility. Invertibility in order to define a group or supergroup in that case. Okay, and that can be expressed in terms of some determinant-like thing, but I don't want to go into the details. And then obviously, once you have two of these matrices, you can multiply them together, and you have a supergroup structure.
But you're restricting yourself to the case n equals n.
Later.
Well, you seem to have written the GL.
I think it's MN.
It's MN, sorry.
Yeah, it's MN. If this is not... That's an N, yeah. Sorry. And, I mean, this is sort of the basic example of a supergroup. And then if you impose further restrictions, you can go to other groups. For instance, you can impose that the determinant is 1 or something like that. I mean, in this case, you would demand that the super determinant is 1. But they are very natural constructions, which allow you to go to other supergroups. And why should we do this? So there's also a motivation for this. The motivation maybe not first of all, but from the work I did first of all in string theory. So in string theory, this would allow you to describe these spaces M in a manifestly supersymmetric way. And I should say why it's manifestly supersymmetric. Because obviously, if you consider your space to be this, then you have an immediate action of some supersymmetry on it. Namely, you can multiply these elements from the left, and that gives you an action of supersymmetry, and you can multiply from the right, that gives you another action of supersymmetry. Okay, so that's something I won't talk about. And then there are several special properties, which makes it interesting for structural reasons and also for condensed matter reasons. Okay, first of all, you have bosons and fermions, and they are coupled in some way. So they're not free because you have the symmetry, and that allows you to, if you do perturbation theory or such things, you can get partially compensating contributions. Okay, let's say partial compensation. In certain calculations. And one of the quantities which, for instance, defines a conformal field theory is the central charge. The central charge gives you the number of degrees of freedom, roughly. And in this case, it turns out that you can have, for instance, C equal to zero, just if you have the same number as bosons and fermions, or you can even have C less than zero, which also shows that these theories are usually non-unitary, because if C is equal, is less than zero, they cannot be unitary anymore. And yeah, that's the next thing. So they're rather special. They can be non-unitary. Oops. Non-unitary. And even logarithmic. So I won't really talk about this logarithmic aspect. I will talk about the aspects that lead these theories to be logarithmic, but I won't say much about the logarithms here. So that's something you can, if you remember the talk of Jürgen Rasmussen, he was talking about these loop models, the temporally leap algebras, and he found a lattice version of these logarithmic conformal field theories. So these supergroups are another example of where you can get these logarithmic CFTs from. Okay. And I will later explain how it arises, but I won't really say what these things are. But I will give you some indication where it comes from. Okay, most important probably is that for certain supergroups, these principal chiral models, and I will abbreviate them by PCM, for certain supergroups, PCMs are conformally invariant. So in that respect, they behave very differently than ordinary groups, which are not conformally invariant. And just to give you some indication what kind of groups these are, so there are strange groups like PSL MM. So that's basically imposing a unit superdeterminant on such matrices when M is equal to N, and then also dividing out some ideal. So, but that's very technical, so I don't want to go into the details. And then you have another class of another series, which is DM plus 1M. That's the OSP series. So that's the generalization of symplectic or orthogonal to the superalgebra case. It's autosymplectic. And then there's an exceptional variant of this, where you have, if you choose M equal to 1, then there's a continuous family of supergroups, and these are called D21 alpha. And yeah, okay, let me stay with that.
In the language of OSP, it's OSP what?
In the language of OSP, these models are OSP 2, M or 2M, I don't know. This one is exceptional.
2M, 2M plus 1, 2M plus 2, sorry. Well, 2. M plus 1 in brackets, 2N.
Okay, let me see it. It's OSP, I think it's 2, and then maybe 2M or M, depending on the conventions.
No. I think there are 2M plus 2/2M.
Because they reduce from equals 0 to the O2 model, which is a free boson here, which has a compactification ratio that varies continuously.
Oops.
It's a generalization of O2.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about this, but okay, I mean, that's something one should maybe look it up afterwards. Yeah. But these D21 alpha are exceptional. They don't belong to this OSP thing.
Not even for special values of alpha.
I mean, if you choose a special value such that it reduces to D21 without alpha, then yes. Okay. So that's the picture. And now I would like to talk a very tiny little bit about the statistical physics applications of this. So if you have questions regarding the general structure, then ask now.
Yeah,
Okay, so last but not least, you have applications in statistical physics. Applications in statistical physics. And first of all, there is Efetov's supersymmetry trick. So, Efetov's Zuzi trick. And I don't want to go into the details. I think it also was mentioned either in one of the last week's talks or the week before. So basically the idea is that you have a disordered system, and disordered means that you have some random variables, some random coupling constants or random gauge fields or such things. So you have a disordered system. And then in order to calculate quantities, you would have to perform the average over disorder. So the idea is, Efetov's idea is that you can express disorder averages of your quantities in terms of correlation functions of some associated supersymmetric model. Oops, correlation functions I mean here if you talk about disorder averages, you have the problem of that you have to exchange sort of the quantum expectation value with the disorder average, and that's something which can be implemented by first going to something seemingly more complicated, namely going to a supersymmetric model, where then the disorder can be performed very easily, and then calculating the correlation function. So that's Efetov's Zuzi trick, and probably half of you know more about it than me, so it might be embarrassing to say more about it. Then it appears in supersymmetry appeared in polymer physics, so I guess that's related to coset spaces where you have either the, what is it called, superspheres or superprojective spaces, such things. I mean, here I'm mainly thinking about a paper by Zaleur and Reed, and that probably is based on many other works.
It goes back to the Parisi-Sur law. Formulation of the ON equals zero limit.
Of these ON things. Yeah. So you have these polymer things. And then last but not least, you have what will be what was inspiration for our work on this, not quantum field, quantum Hall effect. And again, here different sorts of quantum Hall effects, namely spin quantum Hall effect. And the model I will discuss now, I mean not really discuss, but I will outline it, that's concerned with the plateau transition in the integer quantum Hall effect. And that goes back to a proposal of Martin Zirnbauer. Okay. But there's also been work on the spin quantum Hall effect, also by people here in the audience. So the physically most, or maybe most interesting example, also from a different perspective because it occurs in string theory, is what is known as a PSU 1/1/2 supergroup, and that looks fairly fairly complicated and probably doesn't ring a bell. So let me just say that it's roughly the supersymmetric version of SL2R, or if you prefer SU 1/1, that's why you have 1/1 here. Times SU2. And I should probably better put this in quotation marks. Okay, just to give you an impression what it is about. And in that case, it turns out that you have a whole family of conformal field theories. Namely, you have an action which depends on some bosonic coordinates, and then moreover on some fermionic coordinates, which I denote by xi. And it turns out that you can have two parameters. One is called lambda, and it's just some continuous parameter. And then you have the kinetic term, so that's the coupling to the metric G. And then you have a second term, which is called the Vesomino term, which is the coupling to B. Okay, and as I said, two parameters. Lambda is continuous, and K is quantized for precisely the reason that has been pointed out before. Namely, the B field is usually not uniquely defined on the whole group manifold, but you have to use different patches. And then if you calculate the transition functions from one patch to the other, you see that K needs to be quantized. So K is running from, say, 0, 1, 2, and so on to infinity. Oops. And let me draw a picture of that.
The model is conformal for any lambda.
The model is conformal for any lambda, yeah. That's the important point. So for all this, you have conformal invariance. And again, that's something which is typically not the case if you have an arbitrary group manifold. That's very specific to this particular kind of group manifold, supergroup manifold. And let me also say that this PSU 1/1/2, in this list, it would correspond to a real form of PSL 2/2. So it's basically belonging to that class, but you shoot a non-compact version of that. Okay, so I have a two-dimensional diagram or moduli space, if you like. And I have a diagonal here, I mean some imaginary diagonal. And then I have quantized values of k, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And then I have lines here perpendicular to the real axis, or to the horizontal axis. Okay. So then let me say that for ordinary group manifolds, I already mentioned that you have these Vesomino-Witten models. And in this diagram, you also have Vesomino-Witten models. And the Vesomino-Witten models sit precisely on these crossings here. So you have, maybe I should use a different color now. So you have these points here. And they are Vesomino-Witten models. So, and Vesomino-Witten model means you have a very high symmetry. And you might believe that these are, in principle, exactly solvable. And there's still a difference between in principle and in real life, but in principle they are solvable. Okay, then you have a different axis, which is this one, where k is equal to 0. And in that case, you have the principal chiral model. So because you don't have the B field, this term vanishes. You just have the coupling to the metric. And again, in this case, the principal chiral model for arbitrary choice of lambda is conformally invariant. And this is very unique to these special supergroups I wrote down over there. And then you have all these other points in between here on these lines. And these are other conformal field theories. Not much is known about them. The only thing you know is that the symmetry is very small. So here you have a high symmetry, but here on these lines you have a small symmetry. So basically just the conformal symmetry and then a bit more. But this slight extension of your conformal symmetry is usually not enough to really solve these models. Small symmetry. Basically, okay, I mean, you first of all have global supersymmetry, but that's not very helpful in that case. So here you have the currents of your Westermino-Witten model, so a fine current, and here you can consider traces of J to the N, and these are also conserved. Or let's put super traces in this case. So, roughly speaking, it's such things.
It's some sort of W algebra. It's already in the original paper by Hirschfeld.
Yeah, I should maybe say that this picture is based on the observation of Berschatsky, Weintraub, and Zhukov, and later by Berkowitz, Waffer, and Witten. Okay, so this is a picture, and the idea that my collaborators and myself had was to... I should also say there's one more special point somewhere here on this axis for k equal to 1, and Zernbauer proposed that this should describe the plateau transition for the integer quantum Hall effect. So as far as I know, as it has been ruled out more or less by simulations and maybe experiments, and is mainly due to the fact that you have this line of marginal line of deformation. So you can easily get away. There's nothing which stabilizes this point. So that makes it a bad candidate for sort of a physical system, requires lots of fine-tuning. But this was Zernbauer's proposal for the integer quantum Hall effect. Okay. I mean, since I didn't specify any number here, that's probably even all right. Yeah. The program...
The ratio has the meaning, right? So in a sense...
Do you mean the ratio between lambda and k? As long as I'm not on this line, it doesn't really... Yeah, it just corresponds to reparametrization of lambda.
No, so what chooses k equals 1 for this proposal? Why k is equal to
1? That's something I don't really remember.
Well, it comes from Fermions, I guess. That's the idea. 1H state. That's his idea.
Are you going to have a new proposal for the quantum?
Say it again.
Are you going to have a different proposal for the?
No. The only thing I can offer now is some sort of solution for these special points. So I should maybe stress what our program was. So our program, and that has not been finished yet, although we have some proposal also to go away from these points, is first of all solve the Westermino-Witten model. So that has basically been done now. And I will say later more about what the special features of this are, because it turned out to be more non-trivial than expected in the beginning. And then deform the model using perturbation theory. And here the hope is that all the nice features which make these lines conformally invariant also help to do the perturbation theory. Okay, and here we have some ideas and even a draft, but we are not completely sure whether everything we did was completely all right. So we believe that this can be done, but I wouldn't say that we did it right now. Okay, so it doesn't give you any new proposal for the quantum Hall effect. It would just sort of explore this picture. And as I said, it's not only relevant for statistical physics, but also for string theory. So that's was one of the reasons why we also looked at it.
In string theory, what was the meaning of this lambda?
In string theory, this k would parameterize your Neuville-Schwarz flux. And then if you go away from these points, I mean, these red points correspond to string backgrounds where you just have Neuville-Schwarz flux. And if you go away from these points, you would also have a Ramon-Ramon flux. And if you're sitting on this line, you would have a pure Ramon-Ramon flux.
But the meaning of lambda in string theory, what is that?
It would parameterize the Ramon-Ramon flux.
What's a continuous parameter?
It's a continuous parameter because, okay, that depends, that's related to the way you construct these models as a sort of near horizon limit of NS5 brains and things. And then the objects which have a different mass scale than objects which lead to the quantization of this k, and then it looks continuous. Although, I mean, certainly Ramon-Ramon flux originally would be quantized as well.
It comes from the string coupling in some cases, like an ADS5, the string coupling. There's a form. It's d squared n, basically.
Lambda is very big with respect to k. There is only Ramon-Ramon flux. Is that
it? Yeah, roughly. But yeah, that was.
There's no memory of k then anymore.
I would think so. I mean, that was also. I mean, using this construction, I mean, solving the Westermino-Witten model and then doing the perturbations, we obviously cannot say anything about this line, because if we put k equal to zero and lambda equal to zero, that would be a trivial Westermino-Witten model, so it wouldn't have any degrees of freedom. So our idea was, if you choose k equal to 1 and then go very large, then basically it would be the same as being on this line. Yep. But here in this talk, I won't talk about these deformations. I will be less ambitious, and I will just try to explain the main features that enter the solution of this PSU11/2 Westermino-Witten model in a simple example. So here I will explain the main features the main features of supergroup Westermino-Witten models. And I'm not only referring to this particular kind of, but rather general, supergroup Westermino-Witten models. In the example of GL11. Yep. And I should also say that most of what I will be talking about now, or until I stop my talk, will be relevant not only for more general supergroups and supergroup Westermino-Witten models, but probably also for these sigma models which don't have a B-field term, so which are principal chiral models or such things. And in particular, we will see that the features I will sketch also persist if I perturb away from this point. So certainly for this PSU11/2 deformed Westermino-Witten model, and then probably also for the principal chiral model, you will have these features.
This is a conjecture, or?
I mean, for these deformations, you can see it.
You can check in perturbation theory.
You don't lose the structures that you have, basically, if you do perturbation theory. Yeah. Okay, so any questions up to here? Because now I would start with sort of a new section. No? Okay, that's good. So let me... I mean, he already indicated what GL11 should be. Let me be a bit more specific. So I will define the supergroup using the Lie algebra. So that's a similar similar principle as you have for ordinary groups. If you take a Lie algebra and exponentiate it, you can describe the super you can describe the group manifold near to the identity. And here I will use the same parametrization, say, and I will define a Lie super algebra which is called GL11. So here you have small letters. And you can define it in terms of, and certainly you have four generators, namely a 1x1 matrix here, 1x1 matrix here, and the same for the fermions. So what you need to specify are four 2x2 matrices, say, and the four 2x2 matrices are these ones. Oops. So you have a fermion which just has an entry here. You have another fermion which has an entry here, which is called psi plus and psi minus. And then you have E. E should be the identity matrix. And N should be the matrix 1/2 minus 1/2 on the diagonal. So it's obvious that these four matrices generate all the 2x2 matrices. So the difference from ordinary Lie algebras to Lie super algebras is now that if fermions are involved, I don't use commutators to define my Lie algebra, my structure, but I use anti-commutators. And if you do that, it turns out that these fermions have very simple relations, commutation relations with N. Namely, they just have charge plus or minus 1. Everything commutes with E, because E is just the identity. And then you have a non-trivial anti-commutator between psi 1, psi plus and psi minus, and this is equal to E. And all the other commutators and anti-commutators vanish. In particular, the anti-commutator of psi plus with psi plus vanishes, which means that if you use it twice, it just annihilates to zero. And that's obvious from this matrix representation. Okay. So now I use this parametrization and define my group elements. And here I exponentiate the Lie super algebra generators. And I will introduce a coordinate C, which comes with a fermionic coordinate psi plus. And the C is a fermion. So it's a Grassmann odd quantity. It's a Grassmann variable. So it anti-commutes with other fermions. Then I have a bosonic bit, which is just e to the power of I x e plus y half plus y n. And then I have the second fermion, and here I have a fermionic coordinate which I call c bar, and it couples to psi minus. Okay, so, and to say it again, X and Y are light cone coordinates. Yeah, light cone coordinates. So light cone meaning that I have a space of indefinite signature. I have a plus direction, plus one direction, minus one direction, and then I can take a combination of time plus minus space, and these are called the light cone coordinates. And that's this X and Y. And then the C and C bar are fermionic coordinates.
So your world sheet now is not
three anymore? No. My world sheet is just the complex plane. But my target space has my target space M. So this defines basically M. And M is equal to GL11. I mean, these are just the bosonic coordinates, and the fact that they are light cone coordinates was just an additional. It was just an additional statement, which is related to the fact. I mean, you have a two-dimensional space, but you sort of have a light cone because the metric on this space is. And you have two light cones, and then you can take the coordinates. So you would have.
Dx squared minus dy squared is the metric?
Say it again.
Dx squared minus dy squared is the metric?
No, it's more like dx dy, because I went to the light cone coordinates.
That comes from the fact that you group, you automatically inherit a metric on a tangent space, and that's.
Yeah. I want to have a metric which is consistent with the group structure, and that in the case of this superalgebra, it implies that it's one with an indefinite metric for the bosonic bit. And that's why I can use these light cone coordinates. I mean, yeah, maybe I should say it again. Usually, if you have. If you have an ordinary two-dimensional space with the time direction x0 and the space direction x1, you can form these combinations x plus minus, and these are called light cone coordinates. Yes, it's related to the super trace, and if you have bosonic matrices, you know that some object which is invariant is the trace of some matrix. So if you conjugate it with a group element, so multiplied from both sides, then you have the cyclicity property of the trace and everything drops out. So for supergroups, the trace is not cyclic anymore, but you have to use the super trace. So you have to define the super trace of this matrix, and that would be the trace of A minus the trace of B. And basically, that's where the indefinite metric comes from. Yeah. Further questions?
So is there an explicit expression for this metric on the full manifold?
I can write you the metric on the Lie algebra, yeah. But you can look it up in the papers, or we talk about it afterwards. Okay, so once I have this parametrization, I can take my West-Sumino-Witten model and plug in this particular parametrization. So I now have an action, and this action will depend on the coordinates I chose. So it will depend on x, y, c, and c bar. And I don't want to bother you with the details, but if you calculate it, so if you plug it in and calculate it, it has the following form. So you have an integral over sigma again, over the complex plane, and then you have dx d bar y plus dy d bar x. So here you see that you have sort of not diagonal metric, but you combine x with y. And then you have minus 2 e to the power of 2 I ei, and then the some derivative of the fermions. So, and from this expression, you would be able to read off the metric and the B field. So from this expression, you see that it's symmetric. So this gives you immediately the metric, and there's no B field in the bosonic part. But this term is not invariant under exchange of the two fermions. So this one can be split into a metric part and a B field part. And one goes with sine y, and the other one goes with cosine y. Yeah, so this gives rise to a B field. And the metric for the fermion. And I should also say, okay, I have a parameter k here, and I didn't say anything about it. So k can be considered as a.
Because you put this special on that one of these special points, right?
Say it again?
It's no longer because you already have one of these points.
I mean, I'm not talking about this picture anyway. For GL11, you don't have this picture.
It's just this. Okay.
It's just these points, yeah, and not for PSU 1.1/2, but for GL 1.1.
You could introduce different coupling for the kinetic term.
It would not be conformally invariant in that case. In this case, yes, but not in this case. So the K specifies the size of the group.
In this case, it's also conformally invariant. It's actually quite trivial. If you change the kinetic, the coefficient of the kinetic term as compared to the K term. Anyway, we can discuss it later.
Yeah. Okay, let's discuss it later. So the K determines the size of your group manifold. It's the prefactor of your metric. You can also think about K being the inverse of the curvature. So if you send K to a very large number, then the curvature will be very small. So because it's very large, basically. So that's the measure for the size or the curvature. And it also means that if I send K to infinity, then I can basically do semi-classical analysis because I'm in a regime where small quantum fluctuations just don't matter. But I will just use it later. Okay, maybe I should do one other thing before we maybe have a small break. So, it turns out that this model has a very high symmetry. So I already indicated before that Westermino-Witten models have a very large symmetry algebra. And let me just sketch it. So this Lagrangian is invariant under the replacement of G by some holomorphic function multiplying G from the left and some anti-holomorphic function multiplying G from the right. And G is a field which depends on Z and Z bar. So that's a non-trivial statement. And you see that these functions obviously have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, and these ones as well, and they define what you know as a currently super algebra, but I don't really want to define that, and I won't need it. But it has a very large symmetry. So more important is one can introduce auxiliary fields. After introducing auxiliary fields, auxiliary fields, which I denote by B and B bar, one has a different Lagrangian, which depends on the new fields, obviously.
These are fermions or
fluons. They are fermions as well. So you have these C, B, and C bar, B bar. And the Lagrangian looks much simpler in some sense. So you again have a term which looks as follows. So you have dx dy d bar y plus dy d bar x. Then you have a quantum correction which results from some change of the measure of your path integral, and this is subleading. So it goes with 1 over k, and if k is large, it's not dominant, it's subleading. So then you have dy d bar y, so that changes the metric. You can think of this as being the renormalization of the metric in the Westermino-Witten model. And then you have another subleading part where you have a coupling to the worksheet curvature. So this one is basically a dilaton, but again, I don't want to go into the details. You have a background charge. I think it's I over 2. So that's a background charge. And I guess it's I over 2. It doesn't affect the central charge.
Where are the B's and C's?
Yeah, that comes. That comes in the second line. Okay. I mean, I already said it's in some sense easier, in some sense more complicated. So then you have a free a kinetic term for the fermions, which is basically this one. So that's the standard kinetic term for the fermions. And I should remind you that C has conformal dimension 0 because we use it as a coordinate, and B has conformal dimension 1. So that is HB is equal to 1 and HC is equal to 0. And the same for the anti-holomorphic bit. And then I have another term, because that's too simple to be true. And again, the subleading, this extra term is subleading, so it goes with 1 over k. I have an integral over the plane. And here I have e to the iy b b bar. So all in all, I basically can write the action as S0, where S0 means the first line and the kinetic term for the fermions, and then I have an interaction term, which is this one, which couples the bosons and the fermions.
So the claim is that if you integrate out B,
yeah,
using flat matrix, then you get the original.
Yes. So if you integrate out B and B bar, you get original action. I mean, you can basically, since it's all quadratic in the fermions, you can basically just solve for the classical equations of motion and then plug it back again, and you will see that it precisely reduces to this guy. And these things are quantum effects which are associated to introducing these B's and changing the path integral measure. So that's something you cannot see by doing classical calculations. But you can see it if you consider the current algebra and such things.
Else was gained by doing these auxiliary fields.
Say it again?
Else here was gained by doing these
B's. What is gained?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this L0 theory is basically trivial to solve. It's that's linear Dilaton theory, so it's solved. This is a free fermion theory, so it's also solved.
Okay, you just, I see. You
and then.
Right, the Kerr-Kromov theory.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's maybe the last thing I write down now, and then we can have the break.
So all 1 over k terms are included as interaction or not?
No, you also have subleading bits. Okay, they don't go with 1 over k, but just with a constant. But still, they are also quantum effects. So I propose, now starting from this decomposition, is two-step solution. And the two-step solution is, first of all, solve the theory belonging to S0. And that's simple because it's a free field theory in this case. In general, it's not a free field theory, but it would be a bosonic Westermino-Witten model and then the free fermion bit. But again, you can assume that the bosonic Westermino-Witten model is solved.
So what's the anomaly that gives rise to these things? I mean, if you just wind the integrator out of the fermions, I don't see how you can get rid of these terms.
And the way I saw it was from the current algebra. You can define you can recover the original current algebra that you have here if you express it in terms of these x, y's and these b's and c's. And then you see that the kinetic term that you get for the bosons requires this additional Dilaton thing. And you have to have an equivalence of energy momentum tensors. You have an energy momentum tensor here, which is defined by the Sugawara construction. And then you have an energy momentum tensor here for the fermions. And if you forget about this, you would also have one for this free boson bit, but it turns out that they don't coincide. So you have to modify it, you have to give a background charge in the bosonic sector. And then the energy momentum tensors agree. So where you can...
Okay.
Now how you can describe it in terms of some explicit anomaly of your classical action, I don't really know, and I didn't bother about it.
But the central charge is written right now explicitly for any of
the... Yeah, but the point is that this background charge doesn't change the central charge.
It doesn't?
It doesn't, because you have an this degenerate, no, not degenerate, you have this indefinite metric here.
I see. So this is not so surprising. It originally came up in the work by Chamon, Mutri, and Wen, where they tried to do similar things in a different language. And you may remember or may not, the engaged potential part had to be, the coefficient of that had to be put to a particular value. So there's a particular strength of a gauge, and that's equivalent to this correction. People don't know.
It must be some simple explanation. I mean, some explicit explanation of...
And people who did these calculations always refer to a paper by Polyakov and Wiedemann, I think, which was not comprehensible for me, at least. Yeah, so that's the first step. Solve this theory. And then the second bit is treat S int, so the interaction term, as a perturbation. And when I say perturbation, I don't mean that you have a small coupling constant. I mean, obviously here you have a large coupling constant. But since it involves the fermions, and when I say treat as int as a perturbation, it basically means that if you have some correlation functions in your West-Zumino-Witten model, then it can be expressed in terms of a correlation function in your sort of S-naught theory by additional insertions of this extra bit of the action. And then you can do perturbation theory by expanding this. And since you have fermions here in this term, it will be a finite series. So it will be not really perturbation theory. It will be rather straightforward, although it might be tricky in specific examples. Yeah, so that's the picture.
So if I was to declare the coefficient of this perturbation to be lambda, some arbitrary constant, then lambda would be a marginal deformation?
I wouldn't think so, but I don't really know.
The dimension of this thing is certainly zero.
Yeah, classically, but...
Yeah, it's classically zero. So, but
I wouldn't expect it to be marginal for all kinds of lambdas here.
You wouldn't?
I wouldn't.
Why? I don't know, I haven't done the calculation of this language.
It would be surprising.
Okay,
let's make a break here. Okay, so let's continue. I think I should be a bit quicker now. Now there comes some more technical stuff, which is a bit unfortunate that I have to be quicker now. But in this correspondence I had here of the correlation functions, where I pressed the West-Zumino-Witten correlation functions in terms of these S-naught correlation functions, I made an explicit assumption that I know what the vertex operators on both sides are. And let's talk about this in more detail. Because it turns out that here the surprises are hidden. Okay, so if I, for those of you who don't know conformal field theory, and maybe nobody is left anymore, so these vertex operators basically form a representation of the symmetry algebra, which in this case is the conformal symmetry plus the affine current algebra symmetry. but I won't need to make this very explicit. So if we consider the S-naught theory, the sort of free field theory, I have vertex operators for the bosons, and these are just VENs, and they are given by the exponentials of the bosonic fields. So I have EX, and X is a field which depends on Z and Z bar, and then I have N Y, and again, Y is a field which depends on Z and Z bar. So that's E. E and N, yeah. And I have to normal order it.
Responding to the matrices capital E and capital N, the eigenvalues.
Yeah, precisely. That's something I will be more precise about later. Okay, so that's the bosonic bit, and it's easy to check that there are no other vertex operators. I mean, that's just the standard thing. And for the fermions, I just have four choices. Namely, I can take the identity, and the identity is part of this for the bosons. And for the fermions, I have C, C bar, C, C bar. So these are my four choices of vertex operators for the fermions. If I include left and right, holomorphic and anti-holomorphic. And the important observation is that...
What sense is your vertex operators? You could bosonize them with this?
No. It's just representations of the current algebra. Yeah. That's all it means. Vertex operator doesn't mean what you
think. Yeah. Think of if you apply this operator with z and z bar equal to zero on the vacuum state, you will get a new highest weight state of your symmetry algebra. That's what I mean. Okay, if you send k to infinity, I already said you go to the large volume limit or small curvature limit, and then you can neglect quantum fluctuations, which basically means that you can put z and z bar to zero and just deal with zero modes. And in that case, these vertex operators become ordinary functions, yeah, because they just depend on the zero mode. And so in that case, vertex operators can be restricted to be functions in some sense. And then you can also implement the symmetry on these functions, and in this case I restrict myself to the global symmetry, to the zero modes of my fine current algebra, and the global supersymmetry acts on these functions as follows. So that's expressions which have been written down in a paper by Volker.
What now, on M? In the group
one, yeah, yeah. I mean, basically you think about this X, Y, C and C bar as the coordinates, and then you write down arbitrary expressions in these coordinates, and that's your function. And on these functions, you can implement your Lie super algebra as follows. So E would be given by a translation in X. N would be given by E dy, no, I dy, C dc, and then you need the expressions for the fermions. Here you have just the translation in C.
Sorry, dy minus I what? Minus, sorry, I cannot read it.
E dy minus C dc.
C dc?
Yeah.
C bar?
Not in this relation.
Why is this?
Because it appears in the n bar expression. N bar is the right action. This is the left action.
Sorry.
No problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
And dc is simply another Grassmann.
That's the derivative with respect to c.
C is a Grassmann.
It's a Grassmann
derivative. Yes.
Yeah.
No, dc is also a Grassmann
derivative. No, it's a derivative with respect to. So you can think of this as an integral over c, if you like. Whatever. So this is the left action, and then you also have a right action, and the right action I will denote by barred quantities, and these are given by minus I dx. Then you have n bar is equal to minus I dy plus c bar dc bar, And then for the fermions, I have C bar dx, and for the second one, minus I d c bar. So, and now you have your Bart fermions. Okay, and yeah, these operators act on what is known as superfields, or yeah, super functions. And these super functions I will denote by G F of GL11, and think of this as being some sort of L2 space of delta function normalizable functions or super functions. And it consists of functions which have the following form. You first of all have functions which don't have any fermions. Then you have functions depending on x and y which come with a fermion of type C. Then you have functions depending on x and y coming with the other type of fermion. And then you have a fourth term where you have both types of fermions. And these F1, Fc, Fc bar, and Fc c bar, they are considered to be delta function normalizable. So they have a natural basis in terms of these Fourier, yeah, these exponentials here. So you can express all your functions in terms of these plane waves thing.
L2 functions on this.
No,
delta function normalizable.
What does it mean?
Well, they can be plane waves.
Yeah.
So if two plane waves, the inner product is a delta function.
Yeah.
It's
a
non-compact space, right?
Yeah, it's a non-compact space. You can also probably consider the compact version of that, then you would have to introduce quantization conditions. But then you would also get twisted sectors in your conformal field theory, and things get a bit more complicated. Okay, so now that I have these functions, I can also measure the energy, sort of, or give a measure of energy. And in this case, the energy is basically given by, or measured by, the Laplacian. And the Laplacian is nothing else than the Casimir operator. And in this case, with the metric I used, the Laplacian is nothing else than 1 over 2k.
We sort of descended down to the classical level. I mean, are you saying that S naught can be solved purely classically, or is that the statement? So what's the statement?
The statement is that once you solve the classical theory, it's not so difficult to lift it to the full CFT again. Because all the...
It's not only, right? Without interaction.
Even with interaction. That's something I will come to later, but...
Yeah, it's easy to understand because of the current algebra symmetry. All primary fields in a current algebra theory, all conformal weights are a quadratic Casimir divided by the level plus some dual coccidental number, right? So all you need to know is the quadratic Casimirs on this group.
Yeah.
The quadratic Casimirs are purely classical objects, the eigenvalues of the Laplacian in the non-compact space. So that's the whole statement.
But for that point, you don't need the global group. Just the algebra, isn't that true?
The zero mode.
But the zero mode algebra is a global action of your...
All currents that are zero momentum mode in position.
No, so which is just super Lie algebra?
Which is a super Lie algebra.
So why do I need Laplacian?
To measure the energy or the L0 eigenvalue, if you like.
The quadratic Casimirs on the global group are just the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on the global group in a compact, non-compact case. Think about SL2R or something. The principal series representations are precisely Casimirs are J plus 1 or something,
yeah,
right, where J is now continuous. answer, this is a similar story. So you can get
and there's basically
polynomials from the Laplacian.
And also the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian are the primary fields in this limit, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about this in more detail afterwards. I will be a bit more explicit in the following 2 minutes or so, and then if that's not enough, then we can discuss in more detail afterwards. So the
Laplacian is some global thing on the group manifold. But what
you really need is just Casimir of the Lie algebra. But Casimir of the Lie algebra evaluated in these generators here, acting on the space of functions.
It's only the identity. It's not everywhere. It's not the global Laplacian. It's only expressed.
Okay, so you worry about boundary conditions.
Well.
Okay, there might be indeed some subtlety related to that. So, yeah, let us discuss about this afterwards. Okay, the Casimir operator in this case is just En plus Ne, and then you also have a fermionic bit. So obviously this is quadratic. It's not the only Casimir you have. You could also add a term which goes with E squared. And you could add it with an arbitrary coefficient. So in this case you have two quadratic Casimirs. But if you use this one, which is the one which is derived from the metric I used, then you can easily plug in all these differential operators and you can get a very explicit expression, which is 1 over 2k, then you have 2 dx dy, and then you have another term, and this term is related to the existence of the linear Dilaton, if you like, which is linear nx. And what is important in this expression is that the fermions don't contribute at all. So you can just apply it, and if there are fermions, it doesn't matter. So let's consider.
So there's no conformal fit or anything. It's just harmonic analysis now on the.
Yeah, it's harmonic analysis. And I will, in a minute, show why there is a relation. I mean, first of all, if you have affine modules, they somehow look like this. You have ground states here having some conformal dimension h lambda, and then you have higher states sitting here. But if you forget about the higher states and just take these into account, then they transform under a representation of your zero modes. And if you send k to infinity, this h becomes zero.
Maybe we should draw axes so that the y-axis
so this is
L0,
the eigenvalue. This is L0, and this is sort of, if you like, in this case, it could be n, for instance, n0. Or, so n0 and e0 if it's a multi-dimensional picture. But if you send k to infinity, so for k to infinity, these h's would get to zero, and then they behave like classical functions, these ground states. And if I don't use symmetry generators which have higher mode numbers, then I also don't generate these other states, so it's a consistent truncation, sort of. Okay, well, let me
What is the rank of this Z1?
It has a two-dimensional Cartan subalgebra.
You don't subtract neither identity nor the supertrees.
Okay, so the most interesting bit would be to evaluate this Casimir on functions which have the following form. So you take Ex, and then I use a slight rescaling here. So I use n minus 1 y. And why do I use these ones? Because they precisely form sort of the basis of my state space. As I said, I don't have to consider the fermions, so I could have an arbitrary number of fermions here. But as long as it doesn't contain any additional bosonic things, they would all have the same eigenvalue. And now you can plug it in, and you get some eigenvalue out of it. And it turns out that this is precisely given by E over 2k, 2n minus 1. So first of all, you see it can be negative, can also be 0. And there are many representations which have E equal to 0.
E can be negative, N can be negative.
Yep. Okay, and just as a remark, if you compute the exact conformal dimensions, then the expression is given by E over 2K, and then you have another factor E over 2K plus 2N minus 1. So the only difference between these two expressions is this bit, which corresponds to adding a subleading bit E squared over K squared here, roughly speaking. So if you send K to infinity, this term just doesn't matter at all. And you find precise agreement between these things. And if you implement the renormalization, the quantum effect in your classical picture, you can even get the exact result from your classical picture.
And this correction, E is the eigenvalue of the operator E, right?
Yes, E
so
is...
So it's actually the quadratic, the second Casimir that enters here. It's an E dot E term.
The whole picture is still very fuzzy. Mm-hmm. If you had a Wesson in the theory in the very first place,
yeah,
you already had the current algebra.
Mm-hmm.
You already had all the representation theory, all the dimensions, everything.
Yeah.
What's the point of going to S naught?
You will see... You will see.
The problem is that you don't know when you have this current algebra in a non-compact space. It's far from obvious which representations you have and how you deal with them. Because there's so many such a big theory.
But your S naught is still non-compact, right?
When?
Your S naught is still non-compact.
S naught.
Yeah. So yes. It's not easier in that sense.
Maybe it's a free field theory.
It's a free field theory. You should know everything about it.
And I mean, the interesting bit, I will first of all do some calculations in the sort of semi-classical picture for this free field theory in order to get you used to some methods. And then I will later do it for the full Westermino-Witten model, where things change slightly and then there are some surprises. So that's the intention. I first of all want to bother you with very trivial things. And then I will make a step forward and surprise you a bit.
H is a
okay, let me continue. So since by construction this Laplace operator commutes with all the symmetry generators, I can decompose the eigenspaces of the Laplacian in terms of representations of my symmetry algebra. And that's something I would like to do now. So, organize eigenfunctions in terms of representations. Organize in terms of representations, and then I get the following picture. So let me draw a two-dimensional diagram here. And first of all, you see that the quantum number E doesn't really matter because E is constant on representations. So I won't draw an axis for E. I will just draw axis for N and N bar to classify my states. And then let me start with a state which is sitting here at N bar quantum number N and N quantum number minus N. I mean, you will see that if you use this function here and you apply the N operator and the N bar operator, you will see that they have, that their quantum number differs. So they have, one has, here this one has eigenvalue N, if I choose N over there, and this one has quantum number minus N, because they come with a different sign.
So and this point is on the diagonal in some sense.
It's the negative diagonal.
So the origin of this thing is really up
there. Origin.
I should better put this axis up here. Yep. So if I take, if I call these functions here, did I already use a different notation? Yeah. Okay. So that's a bit contradicting what I wrote over there, but if I denote these functions now by VEN, then I would like to have this one as VEN CC bar. Yeah? And this one has quantum numbers n and minus n, because the fermions also contribute to this charge.
Why do you need the fermions?
Because I have this shift here, my n minus 1. I mean, here I just want to have them for the moment. Okay, starting from this state, I can generate a new state by applying I psi plus. So if you look at I psi plus, this I is basically used to cancel this minus I, the DC kills the C, and I end up with V E N C bar. Yeah? Okay. So now I could also use psi minus psi bar minus generator, and obviously this psi bar minus lowers the charge, the n bar charge of the state by 1. So I go here to n minus 1, while this one here is minus n minus 1. And this state would be, okay, I also want to have a minus I here. And if I do that, then I get VENC here for this state. And then I can also go up here, or I can go here to the left. Here I use this generator, and here I didn't really specify it, but it should be simple to work out. So if I do that, then I end up with VEN. And it turns out that these four states form a representation of the combined left and right action. Okay. So this forms a representation. Oops.
So if you separate left and right,
mm-hmm.
It's just
GL1
slash 1.
I have.
Them, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know all the representations, of course, of those things. They're classified
for you. They are, but there are a lot of surprises again. But yes, there are.
In this case, you also take tensor products or something. Or
here?
The tensor of GL left, GL.
The representations in this case will factorize, yeah.
So it represents there GL cross GL.
Yeah.
So there's three tensor products.
Yeah.
Two-dimensional.
Okay, so let's write it explicitly. I have representations of GL11 plus GL11. And in this case, you see that I have a very special representation, because if I apply the fermionic generator psi minus here on this state, I just get 0. On the other hand, if I apply psi plus on this state, I will also get 0. And these special modules are called Katz modules.
So are they decomposable?
They can be, but let me wait for a second. So it turns out that this representation over there can be written as, let me first write it down and then explain it. So, I write it as a tensor product of a representation EN, which is called the Katz module. And Katz module basically means I take a representation of my bosonic subalgebra. In this case, it's the abelian two-dimensional algebra. And then I demand that one of the fermions annihilates that state, and the other one is used to generate a state. So in this case, I have a representation of my bosonic subalgebra, which is this one here. So this defines a representation En with respect to the Bart quantities, with respect to the Bart bosonic quantities. And then I use, as I said, I demand that one of the fermions annihilates it. So if I annihilate, I cannot go in that direction. That's basically what I mean. And the other one is used to generate a new state. That's this one. And this is called a Katz module. And it can be generalized to other groups, to other Lie supergroups.
What is the difference? A Katz module is always the highest to lowest weight representation?
In that sense. But the bosonic bit doesn't need to be in principle. But it's sort of a highest weight condition for the fermions. So, yeah, what I mean is I take a representation, or I take a vector E, n, and obviously it has E and N eigenvalues E and N, or in this case E bar and N bar, because I'm talking about here on the right hand side about E bar and N bar, and then I demand that psi minus acting on it. And now I'm confused, actually.
Psi bar
is equal to zero. So that would define a Katz module. And then the point is that if I use a Katz module here, defined like this, then here I won't get the Katz module, but I would get sort of the dual Katz module, because I use a different fermion to annihilate the state. So that's just what I mean with the star here. So there's nothing deep here. And at the same time, the star inverts the E and the N, so it goes into the negative values. Yep. Okay, is there any confusion left about this? Or... yeah, this is maybe a very unfortunate point, because this could be explained better in generality instead of having this simple example. Yep. Okay, if there are no questions so far, then let me stress something which happens for E equal to zero, there's some special thing going on. Namely, if you take now the other state, you take this En, and you use this psi plus
so
bar.
E is now zero. E equals zero, n. That's what you mean.
Ah, yeah.
Sorry.
So if I now use this psi bar plus to generate a new state, I can ask myself, am I able to go back to the original state? So I can apply this psi bar minus, and then I can use the commutation relations in order to replace this by E bar. And this gives me zero, because I have zero here. So the picture would be, I have a state here. I have a state here, which I denoted by zero n. And then I have another state here, which I denoted by psi bar plus acting on it. But I can just go in that direction. I cannot go back. So I have a one-dimensional invariant subspace. That means I don't only have two-dimensional irreducible representations, and usually these things are two-dimensional and irreducible, but I can also have one-dimensional irreducible things. So this gives me some indecomposable but reducible representation. Okay. And the statement, if I combine all the knowledge that we have, is that the full space of functions is a integral over dE and dN, where they run over all real numbers. And then I have this En star tensor En. But it's important to notice that it has two different parts. Namely, it has a typical part. A typical part, and that's what I denote by E not equal to zero. And then it has an atypical part, where the representations are reducible in this sense, but still indecomposable. And that's the E equal to zero bit. Yep. So, and you can also compare this expression with what you know for ordinary bosonic groups, and in particular with the Peter-Weyl theorem. The Peter-Weyl theorem would tell you that you can decompose your space of functions in terms of matrix elements of your group elements, and then these expressions would just correspond to individual representations, matrix representations. So.
So the integrals are, so this is integrals over continuous, over all real values of
yep.
the unit, right?
Okay, so that was a sort of free field bit, and now I would do the Vestumino-Witten bit. But I'm really running short of time. So.
Okay, let's see. So, which is 3 o'clock. How long will you need?
I have two pages. I would need to write down some generators again if you want to see all the explicit details, or I can just sketch what's happening in the full CFT, and then I would probably just need 5 minutes. But then you probably are not able to really appreciate it completely.
So if you write everything, how long do you need?
Oof.
20 more minutes.
20 probably, yeah.
15, I think I have to leave absolutely in 15 minutes or something.
Mm-hmm.
You wanna try and do it in somehow 15 minutes?
Yeah, I can try to be very quick. Yeah.
I mean, everybody's of course welcome
to leave. You know, yeah.
Way over time.
Yes, I'm sorry. Okay, so the important point is that here we sort of didn't use the correct action of the Lie algebra elements, but we used a fake version. So if you do the full Vestumino-Witten model, so in the full Vestumino-Witten model, you know that the action of your symmetry is implemented in this way. So you take a function sitting in this f of GL1, and then you multiply it here from the left, the argument, and like this from the right, and that gives you how the symmetry generator should act. So if you consider infinitesimal actions of these supergroup generators, it turns out that you get new generators compared to the generators I showed you before. And in general, you have new generators x prime are equal to x, so where x is now an element of the set e n e bar n bar psi plus or psi bar minus. So for most of the generators, you don't change anything compared to the differential operators I had previously. But it turns out that for two special generators, you get new contributions. So here you have psi minus plus I e to the power of I y. And then now here you have an anti-holomorphic derivative, or some derivative with respect to C bar. So in some unbought quantity, you have suddenly a barred derivative. So that's special. And then you have the same for psi, psi bar plus. So the primed version of that would be the original psi bar prime plus e to the power of I y b c. So here you start mixing fermions.
So what do you have to do to get in those expressions? I mean, how is this defined? By this action, I see.
Just the invisible version of that.
So you could consider, for instance, I had this E I C psi plus, and then here's some other stuff. So now I want to multiply from the left with something which is epsilon times psi plus. Yeah? Then I can just use Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff, and I see that it basically shifts C by epsilon. That's why I get the derivative. I mean, you remember that it was just a translation. And if you have some other generator, you need to pull it through, and then you can derive these things. Okay, but more...
Can you remind us where the other formulas came from? There were earlier formulas. So what do you need to get those?
They came from the current algebra construction.
I see. I look at the current algebra and reinterpret it.
I just consider the zero mode sector of the current algebra construction, basically.
Okay.
Or I could also put it differently. We first did this thing and then we forgot about certain terms. But anyway, that's just a... So then you can also calculate the new Laplacian. And it turns out that the new Laplacian with respect to these generators is given by the old one. But then you have an extra term, which is this one. So now you have fermionic derivatives in here. And now you can already see what the main difference will be to the previous case. Namely, if I start with a function which is a bosonic function times the two fermions, then this second term will always kill the fermions. And if I'm in a sector where this delta is equal to zero, then I will never be able to get this original function I started with back from another type of these functions. And then I will get some indecomposable structure for this delta prime. So that's basically the picture. But I want to be quick. Therefore, I just want to say that also the representations change. So the representations change drastically, at least in the E equal to zero sector. And in the E equal to zero sector, one can now get the following diagram. We start with V0n combined with the two fermions. And then in the last example here, we saw that it generates a two-dimensional thing, or this four-dimensional picture if we take both actions into account. Now I will restrict myself to one action, and it turns out that if I use psi plus prime, then I get minus E V zero N C bar, and then I can use psi minus prime again. So that's not a bar, that's psi minus. So in this case, I can apply this again. In the last case, it was just a two-dimensional model and I couldn't go back. But in this case, I can apply it again and it gives me some non-trivial thing. In this case, it gives me V0n plus 1. And I could do the same thing going the other way around. So I have here psi minus, and here something with psi plus. Or I could also apply the Casimir operator. So if I follow the twiddled line, then I have 2k delta prime, and it maps me this generator to this one. So in this case, I have a four-dimensional representation suddenly, which is called a projective cover. So,
particularly
because
the
Casimir is non-diagonalizable. Yep. Yes. So I have a representation where this delta prime is not diagonalizable.
So this is the projective cover of what?
It's denoted by Okay, we denoted it by n in a double bracket, and here, okay, here in this picture, if you just consider this single state, it would be denoted by n. So this n with a double bracket is the projective cover of this n, of the one-dimensional irreducible representation.
So
it's a cover. Yeah, sort of. That's the picture.
It's not a decomposable in that sense anymore, because psi plus prime can be applied again, and have this
No. It cannot apply it again. It's just a four-dimensional thing.
Oh, because C bar is not.
It's a fermion. I mean, you cannot apply it more frequently. Yes, but things change nevertheless. Okay, and now let me just give you the diagrams that I wanted to give, and then I'm done. And again, everything I say here may be extended to other Lie super groups, but you have to be.
Just mean the double prime is not that wide.
It means in your CFT that you have a logarithmic CFT, because basically if you have L naught, this would be given by something which is proportional to delta prime plus higher mode terms. But the zero mode sector would always be given by this one. So you would have a non-diagonalizable L0 and a logarithmic CFT. Okay, so now the fun is combining left and right sector, because now suddenly we have these four-dimensional representations. And if we would consider not the E, these unbound quantities, but the barred quantities, we would also get four-dimensional things. But then it's a matter of how to glue them together in a way such that it's consistent, because before we just had these 2x2 things, and now we have four, and we would have to have 4x1 things, but we would have to have that with respect to both things, and since we have a symmetric situation, it's not so clear how to do that. But instead of talking, I should maybe just draw the picture. So in the original setup, I will now consider a sum over states, namely I will consider the sum over all n's of these en star tensor en, and the picture would be that I have lots of these little blocks here running on the diagonal, and if I reduce the action to the left action, so that would be the picture with respect to the that would be all the states, and these bars here would correspond to Katz modules. But if I restrict myself to the left action, to the right action, then I would get Katz modules which sit here on these lines, and I get them with a multiplicity 2. Yeah. Okay, so that was the picture we had for S naught. But now the picture for the full Westermino-Witten model is different. So again, we sort of have these bars here, these boxes here. But now we have these four-dimensional representations. So if we restrict the action just to the right action, then we would have these four-dimensional representations sitting here, and here you have a double state. I mean, here you also had two states.
You have somehow third direction, and it's like a.
Yeah, I'm looking from the top, sort of. I rotate this diagram and look from the top. So I would have this picture. So that would be the decomposition with respect to the right action. But the important bit is that I would have this picture if I consider with respect to the left action. So you see they are entangled in a way, and you cannot really decompose them anymore. So the the statement is that if I fix the fractional part of n, I basically get a huge infinite dimensional representation with respect to the combined symmetry. So in this case, I would have representations in. I mean, that depends now where I put the n here, but so this was a picture for n equal to 0. So if I restrict the action, then here I would just get 2 times en if I restrict myself to the right action. If I restrict myself to the right action here, I would get a sum over what I denoted by n. So that's restriction to the right action. So, yeah. So you have these huge infinite dimensional representations, and you have a Casimir which is not diagonalizable on this. And in fact, the fact that these left and right movers are entangled in this way is actually a feature of the non-diagonalizability, or an implication of that, because you can calculate that the Laplacian delta is equal to, or delta prime is equal to the Laplacian delta prime bar, where you use the barred differential operators to define it. And this is just consistent with being non-diagonalizable if you entangle them in this funny way, because otherwise the difference would never be able to be zero. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I could write down the function space, but basically it's already done. So this was now just the E equal to zero sector. Maybe I was a bit wrong here. So, I mean, okay, this picture also holds true for E not equal to zero. But this is just E equal to zero. Yep. So maybe one word why I don't want to throw these all away. So if I take a tensor product of E in E minus n plus 1 and E comma n, so really the tensor product in the sense of I act on both factors simultaneously, then I can calculate it algebraically and I just get 0, the projective cover of the trivial representation. So if I want to have a consistent model, I better take all these representations into account.
So that's just a single term in a tensor. There's no sum over anything, right? For each
This is two-dimensional, this is two-dimensional, and this is four-dimensional.
And E and N, again, are any real numbers.
Yeah, but that's very specific for this GL11, because basically the N quantum number doesn't really matter. There's an automorphism which changes the n quantum number. So I just. Yep.
So does it mean that doesn't mean that you have an infinite number of operators with the same.
Conformal dimension?
Yeah, you have a.
Yeah.
Kind of. Not a job on job.
I have many representations with E equal to 0, for instance. Yeah, and all.
If you try to apply a 0 on it,
I mean, the L0 would always act. I have one state here sitting on that side of the blackboard and one sitting inside of. And if I apply this delta operator or L0 operator on the one here, I go in the other, behind the blackboard basically. So that's the action. And it just works for these states where I have two states sitting here on top of each other. For these ones, it would just be 0. Because there is no second state where it could map to.
And that null, is it a null?
Yeah, it's the same.
You stay in the same.
Yeah, you always stay in these representations here.
Do you split the four-dimensional representation? No, you go in the other.
Yeah, but the point about, you know, they always go sort of inside the blackboard, if you like. They don't go in other directions because they are scalars with respect, or trivial with respect to the symmetry. They are Casimirs, so they commute with the symmetries. Yeah, maybe I should say, obviously this was just a semi-classical picture, and now I would have to extend it to the full CFT, and then there's an additional subtlety that not only these representations are sort of atypical, but you generate new atypical representations if you consider spectral flow automorphisms. But that's very technical, and maybe you can ask me separately. Yeah, so basically that's what I wanted to present. And I would like to stress once more that everything I presented here was can be done in a much more general context.
So again, the conformal weight of these IN representations is zero, or?
Which ones?
Well, the IN.
These ones? Here?
For E equals zero, no, you write IN, restrict to the right action. Yeah, right. So there's a bunch of states which are infinite dimensional things that are related to each other if I use both the right and the left action of the group.
Yeah.
And so they're all zero dimensional, or what dimension?
What do you mean zero? Yeah, they
the
all have.
Conformal weight.
Yeah, the conformal weight is zero.
Yeah,
they're all zero.
So do we know, I guess we know how to calculate correlators of these somehow for point functions, have some logs in them.
Yeah, that has been done in this paper already there's a very old paper by Rosansky and Zaleur where they came up with this, which was basically the foundation of logarithmic CFT without calling it like that. But so in that paper they used Nishnik-Zaman logic of equations to derive this. And then it can also be done using this free field, this S-naught decomposition that I sketched before. And that was done in a more recent paper by Volker and Zaleur.
Right. So this is like a Coulomb gas representation, the perturbation with S-interaction term. Right?
Mm-hmm.
This gives a Coulomb gas a formulation of all these correlations, four-point function.
Yeah.
So the Church's morality, the finiteness is ensured by the permanence, right, essentially.
Yeah.
This guy only is finite number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any more questions? We had a lot of questions. If not, let's thank Thomas.